Early in Northanger Abbey, Jane Austen offers a famous defense of the novel. After reflecting on the criticisms endured by women who read and write novels, she makes clear, "Let us not desert one another. We are an injured body. Although our productions have afforded more extensive and unaffected pleasure than those of any other literary corporation in the world, no species of composition has been so much decried. From pride, ignorance, or fashion, our foes are almost as many as our readers." I wonder if Austen's comments may help us to think a bit about the current condition of the humanities within institutions of higher education and beyond. Like novel readers and writers of Austen's age, today's students, teachers, and scholars of the humanities often feel like an injured body, who have been so much decried, and it is vital that we must not desert one another. We may not need another podcast to clarify that the humanities within academic institutions have endured difficulties and challenges over the past 75 years. This is a familiar, if not a rather hackneyed story that dates at least to the 1950s, if not earlier. And this is a story that involves repeated pronouncements of crises, with plot components such as declining numbers of majors, depleted funding, and despondent faculty. More recently, this story has involved administrative decisions to close or collapse traditional humanities departments, political attacks, including violent political attacks on humanities courses and scholars, and public concerns about the elitism of humanistic faculty and topics. While I doubt that Catherine Morland, the young heroine of Northanger Abbey who relishes the adventures of Gothic romances, would find such a story thrilling or provoking, the perpetual declarations of a crisis in the humanities have generated responses of panic, often exacerbating fears about the future of the humanities within the university and allowing politicians and administrators to leverage a rhetoric of crisis to justify impulsive or emergency actions. Most importantly, perhaps, this chorus of crisis continues to inhibit meaningful dialogue about the humanities, especially dialogue with different public communities beyond college campuses. What actually are the humanities? Why do they matter? Why have they mattered? Why do they continue to be so important, and why will they remain essential to our individual and collective lives beyond the university? My name is Michael Cramp, and I'm a faculty member in the English department at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And ever since I read Jane Austen at age 18, I have been pretty much enamored of her narratives, her characters, and her ideas. While many are repeatedly drawn to Austen for her famous stories of romance or the quaint settings of her fiction or her wonderfully witty language, I have found myself returning to Austen as both a scholar and a fan because of the ways in which she treats cultures, people, families, communities, relationships, and other human phenomena as complex realities that merit and in turn invite careful, considered, and continual thinking. Austen invites us to keep thinking and keep learning. Near the end of Austen's defense of the novel, she adopts the voice of a young novel reader. "Oh, it is only a novel," replies the young lady, while she lays down her book with affected indifference or momentary shame. "It is only Cecilia or Camilla or Belinda, or in short, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest diffusions of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language." Austen's support for the novel may be humorous, but it is also emboldening. She invites us not to feel indifference or shame about our fondness for the genre. She refuses to denigrate novels, novel writers, and especially novel readers who enjoy engaging works that display the greatest powers of the mind. This podcast, Jane Austen and the Future of the Humanities, is a deliberate, perhaps shameless attempt to learn from Jane Austen and leverage her stories, ideas, and long-standing cultural appeal to discuss the importance of the humanities another arena in which I believe some of the greatest powers of the mind may reside. I believe that academic scholars of the humanities have struggled mightily to tell an effective story about the value of the humanities to different audiences, and I believe that Austin can help us. I believe we can make use of Austin's famous narratives to tell more effective stories to more people. Austin is a distinct cultural figure who is at once widely popular, vastly respected, and remarkably versatile. And her versatility enhances her ability to speak to various communities, both on and off campus. But more on that topic later. Let's return to the state of the humanities for now, without shame or indifference, and try to figure out what's happening with these ongoing crises. I graduated from Marquette University in 1995 and immediately began my career in academia, entering a graduate program in English at Washington State University. Please pardon my brief nostalgia, but during my time at Marquette, I do not remember a single person cautioning me or even mildly questioning my decision to study the humanities. Not my friends, not my family, not my professors and other disciplines. In the early 1990s, and admittedly I have no evidence but my own fond memories to support this, Marquette was filled with students studying English, modern languages, history, philosophy, and plenty of these students went on to study law and medicine and finance, and each and every one of these students with whom I have kept in contact has gone on to live successful, happy lives. I think as soon as I went to graduate school at Washington State, I noticed a different situation. At a large land-grant university, the humanities were something of an afterthought, present but seemingly experiencing a perpetual inferiority complex that affected the faculty, students, and most assuredly me. In the 30 years that I have been working in higher education, the narratives about the humanities have become at once more dire and more hackneyed. Within higher education, the humanities, so it seems, are in perpetual danger and unending crisis, and this has fueled what I have experienced, or at least now come to describe, as a three-part story that many humanities faculty and staff within the U.S.-based institutions share. The first plot component of this story is a sense of pervasive sadness or remorse, a sadness that ideas and traditions we once experienced or valued are experienced and valued no more. Or at least experienced and valued no more in the way we remember or believe they ought to be. As an integral part of my work on this podcast, I've spoken with various colleagues, including prominent leaders and activists within the humanities. We have discussed the current condition of the humanities, including the very notion of a crisis of the humanities, the enduring importance of the humanities, and the present and future impact of the humanities within our lives. We have also addressed how best to define the very idea of the humanities, especially for different public audiences. When I spoke to Dr. Stephanie Schoeneken, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, she spoke to this tendency amongst humanities scholars in U.S.-based institutions to express sadness and complaint.
I think as humanists in the academy, we have spent way too much time lamenting on our erosion in the public eye or in the public sphere or in the political sphere. And we've spent way too much time thinking and talking about how we're not getting as much attention.
This sadness, remorse, and sense of lament has fostered a degree of mourning and the dangers of nostalgia, leading to our second plot component of this recurrent tale. Bitterness, anger, and despondency from humanities colleagues and students alike. A hopelessness that often manifests as public frustration, private regret, and inevitable withdrawal, including withdrawal from ongoing public conversations about the value and purpose of the humanities, both on and off campus. When I spoke with Dr. Robert Townsend of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and co-PI of the Humanities Indicators Project, he spoke about both this frustration and the very different experience of academic humanists and colleagues engaged in the humanities with public organizations like museums and libraries.
I started going to the National Humanities Conference about 7-8 years ago, And one of the things I found most striking was that, you know, it started as the annual meeting of the Federation of State Humanities Councils. So it's the people who are really on the ground delivering humanities programming to the public. And what increasingly became striking to me was just this disparity between the academics who were coming to the National Humanities Council, many of whom would spend a lot of time lamenting, you know, and in sort of a state of despair about the state of things, especially as majors have dropped off. And then all these public humanities people were constantly just sort of thrilled about sort of how well they felt humanities was going over with their constituencies, with their audiences.
The apparent critical conditions of the humanities within colleges and universities have promoted a sadness, bitterness, and a hopelessness that has all too often framed how my colleagues and I interact with our students and our colleagues, but also with public communities, including politicians. And such sadness, bitterness, and hopelessness has ultimately informed a third plot component of this narrative, an elitism, or an elitist stance. In other words, I sincerely worry that current conditions in higher education have driven many of my humanities colleagues to adopt something of an elitist position about their scholarship and their teaching, an elitism that may be understandable even as it carries great risks. I have heard colleagues say such things as, "No one in the College of Business could appreciate my scholarship," or, "Students in engineering are not good enough writers to pass my class," or, "I'm too busy finishing this book to talk with you right now." This is a plot component with very dangerous consequences for the humanities and the future of higher education. As fewer and fewer students study the humanities, I recognize it is quite logical that my colleagues and I revert to preservationist strategies, doing whatever is necessary to secure the value of our scholarship, our methods, and our teaching for the students who remain interested in and engaged with the ideas, methods, and subject material we value. I also fear, however, that this preservationist strategy has ultimately augmented the crisis narratives surrounding the humanities. As we become fewer in number and cling to preservationist strategies and, at times, elitist logics about the value and importance of our work, the impact of the humanities within and beyond the walls of universities continues to diminish. In other words, crises ultimately breed crises. And as this perpetuates, colleagues, students, and their parents are simply looking elsewhere. And different public communities have picked up on both this crisis logic and this elitism associated with the humanities. Dr. Robert Townsend shared with me the findings of a nationwide study on public perceptions of the humanities, and while most of the results were quite positive, the one consistent critical finding was tied to this issue of elitism.
We did this survey of the public about 2019, so just before the pandemic, and one of the things we found was we couldn't go directly to people and ask them about the humanities. And so we had to shape the survey in a way that walked them through a variety of engagements with different types of humanistic activity that we consider the humanities, and then lead them to a question where we would say, you know, what we've just asked you about, people call the humanities. And so now we want to ask you some questions, you know, which are often associated with, you know, English, history, philosophy. The languages. And so now we want to ask you some questions. And when you structure it that way, and then you ask a series of questions like, do you think these things are valuable for education? We got a very positive response with the exception of one thing, which was the elitism question. Do you consider it to be elitist? It was the only thing where we got more than, and it was close to 50% of the public said they associated those things with elitism, and it was the one negative. Like, they were very positive about all the, you know, a wide variety of other aspects of the humanities, sort of broadly construed, but the elitism piece was the one piece that made them uncomfortable about us.
The findings of the study from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences affirm two key data points. The public remains keenly interested in ideas or issues that we broadly define as the humanities, even if they do not use this term. and the public often associates such ideas as elitist. This pairing may invite us to reframe how we think about the very notion of a crisis of the humanities. There is no doubt, as I mentioned earlier, that the condition of the humanities in colleges and universities is critical. Declining majors, depleted funding, despondent faculty. But this narrative is also undoubtedly more complex as we consider the relationship between the academy and diverse public communities. When I asked my colleagues to speak about the supposed critical condition of the humanities, they, not coincidentally, also reframed the question. For example, when I asked Dr. Robert Newman, the longtime president of the National Humanities Center, to speak to this idea of a crisis in the humanities, he explained how this hackneyed term was really an indication of other kinds of crises.
Well, I guess when people talk about the crisis in the humanities, I think they often mean something more or something else. So when we're talking about the crisis in the humanities, we're also talking about crisis in democracy. We're talking about crisis in crises in civil discourse. We're talking about crises in terms of solving problems of the day or major issues of the day. We're talking about crises in honesty, in transparency, in truth, in reason. So I think just saying crisis in the humanities signals all these other things that are very much increasingly, it seems to me, on our minds these days.
When I asked Dr. Heather Hewitt, a former program officer for higher education initiatives at the American Council of Learned Societies, to speak about the supposedly dire condition of the humanities, she immediately qualified my phrasing.
I think the first thing that I might do is I might insert the adjective academic before humanities, because I understand your question to be about the academic humanities, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I would like to talk also about the humanities writ large, but I actually think the humanities writ large are doing great. We're really talking about the academic humanities, where we have a narrative which has some truth to it about a crisis or decline of interest, student interest in the humanities. And that runs, you know, that includes things like declining student majors in some places, although I will say not all, that's not the case everywhere. A lot of public mistrust and maybe misunderstanding of the value of studying the humanities.
Dr. Hewitt's assertion that the humanities are actually doing great within our culture was striking to me. And she notes how this powerful story of supposed decline or demise has become something of an alternative reality that nonetheless has real and tangible impacts.
If you look at the actual amount of funding, say, from the National Endowment of the Humanities compared to NSF, and even if when you look at individual institutions, very often the humanities are what are underfunded compared to other kinds of schools and disciplines. Having said that, I actually think that that narrative that the humanities or the academic humanities are in decline is itself part of the problem, because I think that it's the story that gets covered a lot in the media, and it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Dr. Hewitt's comments point to a key tension or even paradox that underlies the condition of the humanities. The public seems to engage and value the humanities, even if such appreciation does not translate to institutions of higher learning. Or, to put it another way, diverse public communities appear to understand that the humanities matter in their lives and have great value, but they may not believe that the university need be the epicenter for the humanities. Or, maybe even another way to rephrase this tension would be to say that different public communities clearly value features of the humanities, but do not necessarily believe that colleges and universities have some kind of ownership or authority over defining or distributing the humanities. So what has changed? What's gone wrong? How did the humanities arrive at this moment of tension? As I nostalgically recalled my own university experiences, mind you, with no evidence, I remembered how plenty of students studied the humanities without fear or anxieties. We were not maligned or ridiculed or made to worry about job prospects. We were confident that our training would translate to happy lives and successful careers, and based on my anecdotal research, it has. So what's changed? I think we can point to at least three shifts or evolving issues, and likely many more, that have at once perpetuated a narrative of crisis surrounding the humanities and inhibited or limited the abilities of academics like me to communicate the value of the humanities to colleagues, students, their parents, and other public communities. First, the cost of higher education has simply exploded over the past 30 years, and this has reshaped almost every conversation about the purpose of higher education. While it is admittedly difficult to factor in all the variables, experts note that tuition at U.S.-based colleges and universities has jumped by at least 65% from 2000 to 2021, and this is a conservative estimate. Many institutions have witnessed much higher increases, with some colleges and universities reporting much, much higher increases during this same period. The rising costs of higher education have led to a series of related impacts as students and families have incurred massive debts that inevitably drive or force educational decisions, shifting how we think about the very processes and functions of university education. While university education may once have been about the development of the mind, expanding our thinking or our person, or even providing a chance to explore possibilities as we mature, many, perhaps most, now approach higher education as job training, with a keen focus on return of investment. This emphasis on return on investment has, in turn, altered how universities, administrative leaders, and their faculty and staff understand their relationships with students, and ultimately their parents. Are students enrolled in universities to learn, to study, to be challenged, to think anew, to engage with other students and scholars? Or are they consumers? Are they in university to study entrepreneurship, to build future networks? Are students now customers who have paid money for a service and who in turn deserve high-level customer service? I no longer think this question is easy to answer. The high costs of higher education have no doubt prompted students and their parents to seek out major fields of study that they perceive as high-earning disciplines, engineering, finance, the health sciences, as well as professionalized degrees in fields once closely tied to the humanities, such as journalism or design. We have created and elevated new fields, like the aforementioned entrepreneurship, and established professional degrees that link business with just about anything and everything. Engineering, computer science, health, the arts. In the United States, the financial turbulence of the last 25 years, including the economic crisis of 2007-2008 and the COVID-19 pandemic, have significantly impacted the humanities within academic institutions. Students have increasingly avoided traditional humanistic disciplines in favor of majors they associate with higher and more immediate earning potential. And they have made such decisions with little to no appreciation of, one, what the humanities are or do at the university level, two, the allure of the humanities degree to all kinds of employers, or three, the enduring financial successes of humanities graduates. Our messaging and storytelling to prospective students, their parents, and assorted audiences beyond the academy on all these matters must be better. I spoke with Dr. Robert Townsend about his work with the Humanities Indicators Project, a multi-year project that has tracked how students who graduate with humanities degrees have transitioned into the workforce. Dr. Townsend offers nuanced assessments rooted in his data analysis about the economic return on investment for students who pursue humanities degrees.
I've seen how well these things can kind of work out. The challenge really for us, I think, that we see in the data is in the first couple years after finishing the degree. And I think a key part of the challenge for the humanities right now is just figuring out how we help students through that transition. So, you know, you're going to have a 40-year career, you're going to be quite successful. The first couple years, I think, is really where we're running into some challenges, both with parents and with students, is just that they look at it and to some extent, you know, a humanities degree opens up more opportunities than almost any other degree. We see humanities majors spread across more sort of every non-STEM category of employment, and even some in the computer sciences and STEM, right? But more evenly distributed than most other fields, and so, and which speaks to the fact that you earn a humanities degree, it does open up these opportunities.
Incoming students and their parents are inevitably and rightly concerned about high tuition costs. And the Humanities Indicators Project is designed in part to allay such fears about studying the humanities. Humanities graduates may not make the initial salaries of mechanical engineers or accountants, but according to the data, graduates in fields like philosophy and history and French and English do well and enjoy financial stability. As those of us within higher education know all too well, university administrators are now thoroughly in love with data, especially big data. But this reassuring data on the humanities is quite simply not enough to move the needle on the topic of return on investment. Despite extensive data from such efforts as the Humanities Indicators Project that quantifies issues like the financial value of a humanities degree, the allure of humanities graduates to employers, and the success of humanities graduates over the trajectories of their professional careers, the numbers of humanities majors at most, although not all, institutions of higher learning remain stagnant or in decline. The issues surrounding the cost of higher education and the fixation of parents and students on a return on investment are complex, multifaceted, and have absolutely changed our expectations for colleges and universities, including our expectations for the work of faculty and staff. These changes and the high costs of tuition have also fueled political attacks on diversity and equity work broadly defined, and campus discussions of such topics as race, gender, social justice, or economic inequality. Many humanities scholars certainly address such topics in their teaching and their scholarship, and as politicians and activists have targeted them, others have questioned the value or even the role of the humanities at a university. My own home department at Lehigh University supports a focus primarily at the graduate level in literature and social justice. And we have certainly been the recipient of queries, critiques, and attacks about our work and its supposedly dangerous impacts on learning or the university. I will say more on this topic in the next section, but for now, I want to note simply that these political attacks have provided ammunition for some and merely excuses for others to question the financial viability of studying fields not directly tied to a professionalized vocation. Again, Dr. Townsend.
One of the more striking data points we got out of the National Survey of College Graduates was that our majors are the least likely to see a relationship between their jobs and their degrees. And I think fundamentally that's just because they come out of our classes thinking they've got content knowledge and not appreciating that all the other stuff they did in the class was actually helping them refine really, really valuable skills that they will be able to take out into the workforce.
Humanities graduates, for the most part, do not work in the field that they study. Not all English majors work in the field of English, whatever that is. Very few philosophy majors practice philosophy, whatever we might mean by this. This disconnect between one's field of study and one's future career used to be understood and commonly accepted. Indeed, while parents and students may not like to accept this now, the vast majority of college graduates will, at some point or another in their professional lives, indeed sooner rather than later, work in a profession unaffiliated with their major field of study. It happens, and it will happen more and more as the jobs of tomorrow continue to shift and develop. We used to understand this as an inevitable reality of the amorphous relationship between a college education and the job markets of the future. But we now expect college to train us for jobs, even as the jobs of today shift into the jobs of tomorrow that do not yet quite exist. The high cost of college tuition has now prompted us to look for various kinds of assurances, for returns on investments, for multiple internships that lead to guaranteed employment, for degrees, skills, and professional certifications, and maybe now in our politically divided cultures, for specific ideological training, or perhaps more accurately, safe distance from kinds of thinking deemed dangerous, threatening, or just different from our own. Degrees in the humanities offer something, well, different. And while we have abundant data on the financial viability and lifelong success of humanities graduates, and we know that prominent employers would like to hire more humanities graduates, we are still struggling to convince more students and their parents to study the humanities. Quite simply, while data works to sell other disciplines like engineering or finance, similar data has failed to sell the humanities. The costs of higher education will assuredly continue to rise in the coming decades. And if the humanities are going to survive, we need a different kind of messaging or story. And I'm convinced we need to speak to different audiences, in particular the public audiences, about what the humanities actually are, what they do, and why they matter. And this leads me to a second fundamental shift or issue that has detrimentally affected the place of the humanities within universities, and perhaps far more importantly, within diverse public communities. A prominent confusion about what the humanities actually are. I realize this may sound silly, especially coming from a supposed senior faculty member in the humanities, but I'm quite serious. Academic humanists have consistently struggled over the past 30 years or so to communicate what the humanities are, both in name and in practice. In other words, we struggle both to explain what we mean by the humanities, and then we struggle even more to explain the activities and importance of the humanities to other academics, administrators, and people outside the university, including politicians, prospective students, and their parents. And I think there are some good reasons for this, such as the historical origins and development of the humanities, their contemporary breadth or reach, and the role of the humanities in ongoing interdisciplinary studies that defy easy classification and often do not seem to fit nicely with professionalized studies tied to vocational training. So perhaps let's clarify here and now that when we say the humanities, we are talking about a set of academic disciplines such as philosophy, history, theology, English, language study, and art history. But even as we begin to offer such definition or detail such a list, many or most of my colleagues will correctly add qualifications rooted in both the historical origins of humanistic disciplines and the ongoing evolution of these fields. For example, we could easily note that some of these fields were once combined, or at least closely integrated. We could, for example, consider the past and present of a discipline such as the classics. Or we could reflect on what we now mean by theology, or the study of religions and religious belief and the role of religions within our cultures, now encompasses far, far more than what we once considered theology, even when I was a university student in the 1990s. What we understand today as the discipline of English is not at all that old or established compared to disciplines such as rhetoric or the classics or the study of languages or history. All these fields have shifted, some quite significantly. Academic disciplines, like all forms of knowledge, mutate and change in response to cultural and political developments. And again, much of this evolution is tied to the affinity within humanistic fields for interdisciplinary connection and interdisciplinary collaboration. Dr. Newman specifically addresses the important place of the humanities within interdisciplinary studies.
Well, I mean, I think the humanities have always been at the forefront of interdisciplinary studies also. I mean, the humanities have moved interdisciplinarity forward more so than any other area of study. And, you know, a vibrant university, in a vibrant university structure, disciplines will morph. They always have. And we have to allow them to morph. But, you know, universities, for all the accusations from right-wingers that they are bastions of neo-Marxism, you know, universities are some of the most conservative institutions that we have in this country and abroad as well. And they are, you know, departments or projects or products, rather, of kind of budgetary, archaic budgetary structures, or personalities that maybe no longer exists within them. And it's hard to sort of get out of those dimensions. But I think some of the best work that I've seen being done, some of this creative work that's being done, is interdisciplinary work, and it often exists in centers and institutes, not in department structures, where people come together from different aspects of the university to work on problems or projects or whatever. Or centers like this one, where we try to build an intellectual community of people working in a variety of fields that are either, you know, squarely in the humanities or kind of adjacent to them.
This interdisciplinarity has led to tremendously important teaching, scholarship, and intellectual innovation. And this relationship between the humanities and interdisciplinarity has been generative, but also messy, confusing, and not always beneficial for institutional funding and support, especially when we try to explain what the humanities are, often in opposition to, or, let's be honest, in competition with other disciplines. Dr. Newman offered a helpful approach to this messiness when I spoke with him, but he first acknowledged that we have something of an issue expressing the core identity of the humanities.
What constitutes a good life? How am I fulfilled in my career or in my life? How do I know the truth? How do I preserve democracy? How do we maintain civil discourse? You know, there's things that most people are very, very concerned about. Are the underpinnings of those things are humanities questions and things that we explore through the humanities. However, most people do not understand that their origin is in the humanities, and that's part of our problem. I mean, I think part of our problem in the humanities is that we have no core identity. And, you know, that's how things have evolved, and in many ways it's purposeful. So what people think of when they think about the humanities typically, including students who are majoring in humanities fields, are a set of disciplines. You know, I'm an English major, I'm a philosophy major, I'm a history major. When I was dean of humanities, most of our students didn't realize they were graduating from a college of humanities. They realized they were graduating from a particular department.
Dr. Newman, of course, recognizes that we could point to a series of disciplines that we traditionally associate with the humanities, but he also indicated that these disciplinary boundaries do not mean much to people outside of the university. Instead, he recommended that we foreground storytelling and speak about two methods integral to the humanities. One, interrogation, and two, bridging.
I like to think of the humanities having sort of two essential methodologies, one of which is interrogation. We're always asking, how can we do things better, or how can we do things differently, or what's lacking in this kind of status quo? So interrogation, questioning, is so fundamental to all methodologies behind the humanities. The other is bridging. So what we do in the humanities often is connect things that were previously disparate, that were previously unconnected. We find creative ways of making those connections. And I think those two kind of fundamental methodologies aid us substantially in solving problems.
I quite like Dr. Newman's explanation of these humanistic methods for a few reasons. First, I think these methods make sense to people outside the university, including prospective students and their parents. When we study the humanities, we learn to ask questions, challenging questions that have not yet been asked, and often questions that many might be hesitant to ask. And when we study the humanities, we learn to knit together questions, ideas, issues, and possibilities. We learn how both problems and solutions are related rather than isolated phenomena. A few years ago, I was working on a project with a chemical and biomolecular engineer who made a fascinating observation that still resonates with me. While we were working to finalize a grant proposal on community-based hydrogen fuel cells, he explained to me how engineers were tremendously good at isolating and solving a single problem. And he then quickly added that they were rather poor at recognizing how the solution they identified might neglect 5 or 6 related problems, or create 3 additional problems, or perhaps even ignore 3 additional solutions. But as he assured me, engineers are quite well trained to solve an isolated problem. In the humanities, we work differently. We approach problems, challenges, and ideas in relation, and this complexity often impedes simple solutions or quick conclusions. But it allows us to ask questions, interesting questions, and make compelling connections. Interrogation and bridging. Part of academic humanists' struggle to explain the humanities to colleagues outside of humanistic disciplines and within public communities beyond the university has been this complexity inherent in our disciplinary methods. We don't solve problems simply. We don't ask standardized research questions, and we don't apply or follow documented formulas. We can't point to a series of terms or equations to which we always or inevitably adhere. We don't train our students to abide by instructions or stick to a manual for success. Dr. Newman offers a creative assessment of humanists' behavior and mindsets that, I feel, captures the appeal of our methods, as well as something of the public's ambivalence or even reservation about these methods.
So we in the humanities are kind of, kind of the teenagers of everyday life. We're not comfortable with things. We're always asking why. We're kinds of the pains in the ass of society.
One could easily imagine why people may not want to surround themselves with the teenagers of everyday life. It may not be a stretch to fathom why parents do not want their children growing up to be the pains in the ass of society. But as Dr. Newman concludes, these two humanistic methods, interrogation and bridging, are foundational to both the present and the future of dynamic job creation and employment.
And so we are a set of methodologies and disciplines that are instrumental to solving fundamental problems of the day, as well as just sort of daily problems of the day. They empower us with not just empathy and compassion, but also focus and discipline. They allow us to make clear and credible and substantiated arguments. They allow us to think more broadly and reflect. They teach us to listen carefully and to study things through close reading, to concentrate. And, you know, I can't think of any more fundamental skill sets for job creation. And so when I was the dean at University of Utah, I used to go around to the major employers of many of our undergraduates and ask them, what do you see that's lacking in the entry-level people that you're getting? What are the major things that they're lacking that you're inheriting? And they would almost always say communication skills, writing skills. They would say, you know, the technical stuff we could teach them on the job, but the ability to communicate well, to write well, and also the ability to think outside of a box and to be creative and to connect things that would not normally be connected, to think of new things creatively, that's what we need more of. And that's what we do in the humanities.
So, if the humanities do these great things, and if they are so vital to present and future employers, it would seem rather essential that we figure out effective strategies for talking about them. We are again back to those questions. What are the humanities? What do they do? And why do they matter? Dr. Stephanie Shonikin echoed such an importance and emphasized the global condition of the humanities.
So when I think about the humanities being in the shadows, being pushed into the shadows in the United States, it's something that makes me really feel alarmed and a little sad, because the rest of the world kind of looked towards the United States as a place that really valued history, really valued culture, how people have evolved and lived, and to see that being kind of peeled away is alarming. So as countries take on structures of the IMF or the World Bank take those loans and so on, how are the humanities engaged in thinking about, if we take this loan from the IMF, aka the United States, right? You know, how will that affect these different small ethnic groups across West Africa? You know, what has their history been with imperialism and with colonialism? How do we communicate the effect of the loan on the people in this village? That's language, you know, that's philosophy, those are ethics, that's history, that's the humanities. And if we don't engage the humanities in those conversations, then we are setting up communities across the world.
As Dean Shonekin makes clear, this is not an issue isolated to U.S.-based institutions of higher learning, or even an issue isolated to education. To address the global plight of the humanities, according to Dean Shonekin, we must improve our storytelling on and about the value of the humanities.
We need to do a better job as humanists to tell the story of what the humanities are and why they're important. And that's on us. That's not on Congress. That's not on politicians or even on my colleagues who are deans in other parts of the campus. That's our job.
We seem to have arrived at some general consensus that, one, the humanities really matter, and two, we need to improve and likely alter our strategies for how we tell stories about the humanities. But while we may have identified a key problem to solve, we may also have unearthed another problem. Very few people outside of academic institutions actually understand or even use the term the humanities. In other words, prior to arriving at colleges and universities, students do not study the humanities. They take courses in Spanish and history and English and French, study religion, but quite often through a doctrinal lens, and maybe encounter a one-off class in philosophy. But they rarely recognize such classes as a unified field understood as the humanities. And they certainly do not group them together in the ways in which we now group together the natural sciences or STEM fields. And perhaps even more importantly, once students depart a college campus, the very term the humanities may simply be irrelevant. Again, the ideas, methods, and practices of the humanities, as we have seen, remain deeply important and valued by various public communities outside the university. But the term has little to no currency or meaning, and perhaps more accurately, is simply unnecessary. So is it really essential for academics to continue their tireless efforts to define or explain the humanities for various public audiences, including prospective students and their parents? Should we all schedule a series of meetings to rehash departmental mission statements and websites? As a parent of students who have recently graduated and entered university, I'm not at all convinced this is a good use of our time and energy. Instead, I would encourage us to focus on telling stories about what we do in our teaching, in our scholarship, in our collaborations with different public communities. French professors at universities are not much like French teachers in high school. College-level history classes do different work than the AP history class. English faculty members at universities spend very little time explaining the difference between a simile and a metaphor. Employers recognize as much. They have consistently seen the value in the training of humanities graduates. And this is why the data repeatedly tells us that they want to hire more. Dr. Robert Townsend spoke about the ongoing allure of humanities majors to prominent employers within the context of the rise of generative AI.
I was just talking to a reporter yesterday who pointed me to a quote from Mark Cuban, which echoed something that the CEO of BlackRock just said recently, which is that with the growth of AI, they both see the AI is kind of doing away with many of the jobs that STEM majors are actually going to do. And they both specifically said you know, that the people person that we were talking to was like, well, so where are you going to find the employees of the future? It's like, well, we're looking for history major, history, English, philosophy majors, because they approach these questions, they see things like AI, they see things like the text that's generated by AI in a completely different way, a much more lateral, you know, a more lateral way. They see the gaps, the ambiguities in it. And it's like, those are the sorts of people that we're going to need in the future to actually know how to handle and take this information and then build on it in ways that are actually creative and development. Like, you know, an engineer can only get you so far in terms of their thinking about the structure, the widgets, you know, that you need people who are creatives to actually come in and really open up the limited sorts of information you can get out of some of these things, which tend to be very binary and somewhat restrictive in their thinking. And so I actually feel like if the CEOs see it, then maybe we should be a little bit more optimistic about it from that perspective as well, because I mean, they're naming our disciplines as the place that they want to start looking for workers. So
what we do in humanities classrooms and scholarship and collaborations is valued and in demand. Our challenge is to communicate this work clearly, to come back to Austin's words, without indifference or shame. If it is true that the public does value the humanities, but just may not know that what they're valuing is known as the humanities, can we bridge this gap by telling engaging stories about our work that are accessible? Can we make our methods and our impacts clear? This is, I believe, the basis for a third challenge or shift within higher education that has deeply and detrimentally affected the humanities. The insistence to chart, quantify, and assess outcomes, at times dubbed impacts. Administrators, politicians, and now parents want to know what your class, your program of study, your research, your collaboration, your mindset produces. What's the outcome? Where's the internship? What's the impact? When I went to school in the 1990s, I don't remember anyone completing an internship or speaking about outcomes. This shift over the past 30 years has been extremely challenging for the humanities. My colleagues and I, admittedly for the most part, are not terribly fond of having to assess the outcomes or impacts of our work. We much prefer to think of the outcomes of teaching and research as ongoing, rather difficult to quantify or sometimes even qualify, and not easily categorized into neat tables and charts. The humanities enrich our minds with the capacity to embrace ambiguity and complexity, enhance our problem-solving skills, and strengthen our abilities to relate to others, especially those who are fundamentally different from us, helping us to empathize and communicate across differences and collaborate effectively. And by way of reminder, employers love those skills. Perhaps it starts to sound increasingly clear why various employers want to hire more humanities majors. Still, it remains challenging for academic humanists to package outcomes for administrators, politicians, and parents and students. We don't train students in different software systems. We don't certify anyone in anything. We don't teach people to build robots or machines or bridges, and we don't prepare them for a specific job or career. We help students prepare for a life of complexity, change, uncertainty, and innovation, for a life of shift, not unlike the past 30 years, a life in which many of the jobs of today will be gone within 10 to 15 years. And the craze for assessing outcomes and impacts leaves academic humanists in a bit of a predicament. If we lean into the outcome game and we try diligently to detail and delineate exactly how we help students get jobs, we risk losing out to our colleagues in computer science, mechanical engineering, and entrepreneurship, who teach ostensibly hard skills or offer various kinds of professional certifications or provide training in software programs and create networking opportunities with major corporations. If instead we lean into the less quantifiable and less qualifiable benefits of the humanities, problem solving, communication, collaboration, We fail to impress administrators and politicians who make funding decisions, and we really fail to impress parents and prospective students who face mammoth tuition prices and daunting student loan bills, and who will soon make important decisions about college. When I spoke to Dr. Heather Hewitt, she encouraged us to emphasize the outcomes of humanities coursework, but she also cautioned against reducing the humanities to skills.
I do not think we should reduce the humanities to skills at all. I think that there's much more that the humanities have to offer, right? But I do think that being articulate with students about skills, about methods, about mindsets, about habits of mind, competencies, I think that is really important. And so I feel like sometimes we have these conversations about skills and we think, and often it is because we're feeling pressure, that there's skills just for work. But that's not actually what I mean. I actually think humanities teaches us things for life.
I like Dr. Hewitt's discussion of habits of mind, and I think this terminology helps us to incorporate some consideration of skills while thinking about broader intellectual development and ongoing curiosity. Like many of my colleagues, I worry that by leaning into the supposedly concrete or quantifiable skills and outcomes of the humanities, we both play a losing game of assessment and lose the larger impact of our work, benefits that escape spreadsheets and data points and slideshow presentations. Dr. Newman encouraged us to think about the outcomes and impacts of the humanities through the major crises of the day, crises that, as he insists, need a humanities perspective.
Look, there are crises that we're facing, major, major crises in the world, and they need a humanities perspective, and we need to be in conversation with others about them. So people come together over adversity. When we have a crisis in the world, typically we'll come together over that crisis. We have so many crises that are facing us today, more so than at least any time I can think of in my lifetime. And this is not to say that it's more so than ever in history, et cetera. It may not be. It may. I don't know. But the major crisis that we can talk about more that I think of that we've tried to address to some extent here at the center is the planetary crisis having to do with climate change, which will affect all things, is affecting all things. It can create massive wealth disparity, tremendous diasporas, massive poverty, massive famine, potentially, unless we address it effectively. And we can't just do it through technology alone. We need to think about skill sets. We need to think about how do we change our thinking in terms of how we approach the world. And those are all humanities challenges.
I firmly believe, as Dr. Newman notes, that the humanities are integral to addressing and solving any pressing crises of today or tomorrow. We will not resolve the climate crisis or rising political extremism with a new technology. We will not resolve health disparities with some new drug or a mixed methods study. We will certainly not stop genocides or terrorism or nuclear proliferation by relying solely on STEM fields. Accountants will not bring an end to the pressing issues of food and water scarcity. The outcomes and impacts of the humanities are at once so very difficult to assess and so very vital. As Dr. Newman told us, we interrogate and we bridge. As Dean Shonigan makes clear, the humanities hold global importance. If we are to meaningfully address any of the major crises of today and tomorrow, we will need to ask new and challenging questions and knit together such questions, answers, ideas, and possibilities. We will need the humanities to remain integral to our intellectual development and integral to our lives. At this point, I'm not at all interested in suggesting that my colleagues and I in the humanities advance the greatest powers of the mind that Jane Austen shamelessly associates with the novel. In all seriousness, I worry that such claims might only exacerbate the claims of elitism often associated with the humanities or invite additional extremist political attacks. Again, to borrow Austen's language, academic humanists have no doubt become an injured body. And from pride, ignorance, or fashion, our foes are as many as our readers. The humanities face undeniable challenges, and maybe even a foe or two who acts out of pride, ignorance, or fashion, whose actions in state houses and boardrooms have detrimentally affected us. But as I hope has become clear throughout this episode, the ideas, values, and methods of the humanities remain deeply valued, even if we don't always associate them with the humanities. In the spirit of full disclosure, I have never heard university administrators denigrate the value or work of the humanities. I would like to believe that every administrator with whom I have worked sincerely values the humanities, but I'm not always convinced they understand what we do. And as I've tried to suggest today, much of that confusion may lie with humanists. Likewise, I have come to fear that too many members of various public communities all too often conceptualize the humanities as Austin's young reader who remarks, "Oh, it is only a novel," and lays down her book with affected indifference or momentary shame. Those people who find value in their experiences of the humanities, in books and museums, in readings and civic events, in political gatherings and rituals, may appreciate the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest diffusions of wit and humor, but may not trace this work back to the humanities. I think Jane Austen can help. When I started this project, I first spoke to my dear friend and brilliant colleague in the English department at Lehigh University, Dr. Lyndon Dominique, who was also the director of the Middlebury Breadloaf School of English in Vermont. I asked him to speak to his sense of the current condition of the humanities.
It seems to be all doom and gloom at the moment, right?
Of everyone with whom I spoke, Lyndon may have been the most blunt and direct about the state of the humanities. As a practicing academic and dedicated teacher, he has experienced firsthand the dire conditions of the humanities. And when I asked him about a path forward, he was equally direct.
But I think it's because there are no superheroes out there claiming the humanities as the kind of front ground for where we are as a society now.
Well, I have no superhero in mind, and I doubt that any superhero or savior is on the way to save the humanities within colleges and universities. But again, I think Jane Austen can help. I believe we can leverage Jane Austen's stories and popularity, her versatility and appeal, to communicate not skills or outcomes or impacts or methods, but experiences, what I call humanities experiences, that we in the humanities teach and develop and write about quite well. And I think these are ideas and experiences that Austen shows us and dramatizes in her fiction extremely well. In Northanger Abbey, Austen shows us how knowledge is a process that inevitably involves ignorance. In Sense and Sensibility, she illustrates how human relationships are messy. In Pride and Prejudice, she details how change affects everyone, whether you like it or not. In Mansfield Park, we learn how resiliency is at times quite disturbing. In Emma, she exposes how living in community is hard. And in Persuasion, we come to appreciate how there is simply no script for happiness. I identify and analyze these impactful lessons through Austen's fiction and frame them as accessible concepts for various public audiences. Again, I don't present these as skills or outcomes or methods, but I think these experiences stay with us, inflecting and informing how we progress through jobs and relationships, challenges and changes, chaos and turbulence, allowing us to adapt to different situations and cultures, developing new strategies and new modes of thinking. Again, I think all of these experiences are extremely valuable and impactful for addressing major crises of today and tomorrow. We need to understand the complexities of community, appreciate the difficulty of human relationships, and value the precarity of happiness to resolve major crises like climate, extremism, hunger, genocide, and health disparities. Over the next 18 months, as we celebrate the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen's birth, I will devote an individual episode to each of her completed novels, paired with one of these humanities experiences. And I think Austin can help us to appreciate these experiences because she has a distinct cultural standing. She's respected, popular, versatile, and for the most part, generally liked, if not beloved. I will address this distinct cultural standing in the next episode. For now, thanks for listening, and I will end by recalling Austin's opening comment about her own heroine in Northanger Abbey, Catherine Morland. No one who had ever seen Catherine Morland in her infancy would have supposed her born to be a heroine. Maybe not, but as Austin shows us, anyone, even Catherine, can meet new people, learn and overcome challenges, and become a person with a compelling mental life. I have never really been much of a believer in heroes or heroines, but I know Austin is a distinct and vital cultural resource. And I believe she and her stories can truly help us to communicate the importance of the humanities to diverse public audiences. I hope you will join me for this story.